listen to them and hear their story. I want to raise the issue of Haitians. So what I want to do is take those groups that are under attack by this president, visit with them, talk to them, and if it is viable to run for president of the United States, and that is the best way I can raise their issues and make sure that the Democratic Party is engaged in those communities, I will do that.
Congressman Luis Gutierrez, Democrat of Illinois. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. The time is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is Abe and Joe Talk Radio.
KBOO provides free training in all aspects of operating a radio station. We're looking for people to join our community of volunteers by evaluating our on-air programs. We have an evaluation training on Thursday, December 14th at 6 p.m. at KBOO Studios, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This class teaches about the evaluation form and minute-per-minute form, music versus PA versus news program evaluation, and about objectivity and opinions relating to KBOO's mission, vision, programming charter. If you're interested, please RSVP by email to del@kboo.org. Again, that's Evaluating KBOO Programming, a training class taking place Thursday, December 14th at 6 p.m. here at your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Chamber Music Northwest and KBOO present Bach's Complete Solo Violin Works with Christian Tasloff on Saturday, December 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Tasloff is a Hamburg-based violin player who is known as a performer who explores the limits of feelings and musical expression through the violin. This performance of Bach's masterpieces will feature the equivalent of two concerts with an extra-long intermission. Again, that's Bach's Complete Solo Violin Works with Christian Tasloff on Saturday, December 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College, 0615 Southwest Palatine Hill Road in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Good morning. First of all, if you're trying to call us, don't. Here's the deal. The gods of ancient copper wire have declared war upon the modern state. That's right. Copper wire is undoing us. We have no incoming phone lines. We cannot talk with you. We cannot, in fact, do real talk radio. Don't run away. I will attempt the unattemptable. I will tell you some stories and maybe amuse you. It's going to get a little egotistical, I will admit, but what the hell can you do? I'm going to talk about what I plan to talk about in the first place. First of all, I want to tell you that you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is, despite all the failings of the modern industrial state, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe Proctor and me, Joe Uris. Abe is not here, ironically, because I'm alone, all alone, and I can't talk to you because our lines are down. I want to repeat that. Our lines are down. So I'm not going to say the number. Why bother? I want to talk a little bit about the theory of end-state capitalism, boring but important, and I want to talk about what's happening in modern industrial states, in Europe particularly, but also in the good old USA. I'm going to talk about Austria, Hungary. I'm not going to get into detail, but Austria, Hungary, Germany, France, and most interestingly, the United States of America. And the theory of what I've read and I believe to be true, that there is a path that modern industrial societies follow, and we are following that path, probably leading the way. And I'll talk about that a whole bunch. I also want to tell some stories, I guess, because what else can I do in the face of the failings of the system? Anyway, to begin with, the theory. Here's the deal. In a lot of the classic Marxist writings and anarchist writings, the two, by the way, are not synonymous, there is the notion that capitalism runs a certain path and that if it is successful, as it generally is, a great system of money-making and delivery of goods and services, it has its costs, however. In the course of such a system, inevitably, money bunches up at the top. It not only bunches up in terms of who has it, but in terms of the number of agencies, people, companies, and so on, that control it. And what that means is, no matter how creative or brilliant we are, no matter how great our startups are, no matter how wonderful our new stuff is, in the end, in the long run, what ends up happening for sure is that the money, as I say, bunches at the top, and that the little guys, the smaller independent operators, the more interesting regional outfits, either the small farmer yields to the bigger farmer yields to the agribusiness, and so on. Well, the same is true for any other means of making a living. So, and we're seeing that. I mean, you know we're seeing that. Corporation after corporation absorbs, takes over, controls corporation after corporation. Big media companies are swallowed by bigger media companies. Big automobile manufacturers are swallowed by bigger automobile manufacturers. And all of this really gives the working class, and I want to use that term a lot because it's really important, working people are given less and less say in their lives. The fact of the matter is that with all the struggles of labor, which I am not going to spend a long time talking about labor history today, mainly because I'm not prepared to, but with all the struggles that working people have endured and all the successes that have come about, more in Europe, where they have actual social democracy, which I'll explain in a second. You probably all know that, but I'm going to explain it. With all of that, the fact of the matter is that working people, for example, in the United States, are earning less real dollars today than they did 10 or 20 years ago. And that means skilled labor. We're not talking about just somebody who, I don't know, mows your lawn or something. We're talking about people with real skills, mechanics, engineers, people whose incomes should be really good in the middle classes are finding themselves having a hard time making ends meet. This is not an accident. It's not a, let me be clear, it's not a conspiracy to hurt people. It's the inevitable outcome of greed. And greed is the inevitable outcome of capitalism. The raison d'etre, the reason for capitalism, is to provide money, to make money, to make people who are lucky enough to be in a situation where they can do that extremely rich. There is no check or balance on that in this modern state. In fact, we're about to have an incredible piece of legislation, 500 pages, most of which nobody's read, with side notes that cannot be read, that are part of the action. We're about to have the Congress ram that through, and it has lots of bad things tucked into it, and there's almost no likelihood of it being blocked. Well, I think there's no likelihood of it being blocked, in fact. What that will do over the long run is it'll at first give some people some tax advantages, and then within 10 years, that will be gone, and the wealthy will be more wealthy. This is greed in its ultimate form, and greed is the ultimate necessity of a capitalist state, particularly a monopoly capitalist state, which is kind of what we are. And as Gekko said in the movie, greed is a quote-unquote good. So we are experiencing that. But also, in order to have that, the state must be powerful in a military sense. And that means that large nation states get to dominate the world's politics. And the United States is, above all else, the largest military state ever in the history of the world. Let me repeat that, because it's really important to understand. We are the big bad boys in this game. We have all the nuclear weapons that we could ever need, enough to destroy the planet, literally, in terms of its survival of living things. We have the weapons to destroy any country. It doesn't mean we can win. Ironically, because of human willingness to fight for a national interest or personal interest, that doesn't guarantee us victory. And we don't know how to live with that. We have had countless wars that are stupid, the two Gulf Wars, which were about oil, and Dick Cheney's insanity. And we have had before that the Vietnam War, which went on and on and on and on and on to support the old colonial system, first under the French. And by the way, I want to emphasize this because it's really important. The United States offered France, when it was facing defeat at the Plain of Jars and Dien Bien Phu, the United States offered the French three nuclear weapons. It's a fact. I'm not making that up. The French said no. They didn't see how it would tactically be to their advantage. And I think a lot of wiser heads outside the U.S. realized that entering into nuclear war a second time, remember, we're the only countries ever used nuclear weapons, entering into nuclear war a second time would be probably a fatal mistake. So we didn't do that. We almost, of course, as you know, in our struggle over Cuba and the opportunism of Khrushchev in the Caribbean, in his effort to place medium-range ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads in Cuba, almost came to a nuclear war. Kennedy and his advisors, not following the direction of a lot of their military people, sought a solution to this problem, a way to back down. And what they did, and I think maybe a lot of you know this, but maybe a lot of you also don't. What we did was make a deal to save face for the Soviet Union and to save face and save the world from a nuclear catastrophe. The U.S. agreed to remove its intermediate range ballistic missiles from Turkey in exchange for the withdrawal of the planned nuclear weapons and already existent nuclear missiles in Cuba. Ships were coming toward each other. A crisis was inevitable, it seemed. The military were all gung-ho, but wiser heads prevailed, and we withdrew from that position. I'm old enough to remember it. I remember the hysteria. I remember the fear. I actually know a couple of guys who fled to Canada around this issue, not because they were avoiding the draft, which was a thing since the late 1940s for guys, but men fled, women fled, people fled, families fled in terror for the possibility of nuclear war. Now we have a president who is so stupid. I want to call this guy out because he is not only egotistical, not only I don't like to, being an old guy myself, I don't like to label anybody as senile. But if there ever was a president of the United States whose mental capacity was highly limited by his age and his diet, remember, this is a guy who eats four big burger buzz, two of them hamburgers, two of them fish things, and then a big chocolate shake. This is a guy who eats that at lunch, and you look at the dude, and he is not. He doesn't play tennis. He doesn't do anything but play golf, and he does it in a cart. In fact, he doesn't like to walk. He doesn't like to have any kind of physical activity. And if you look at him, I'm sorry. I don't like to fat shame, and I don't like to point out the failings of human bodies, because we all have those kinds of problems for sure. But this dude cultivates that in himself, and he is incredibly ignorant. One of the things he said, one of the reasons why his Secretary of State called him an idiot, or what, I can't remember the words, but one of them is with the F word, was because he just doesn't understand the consequence of nuclear war. He thinks big bomb, bigger bomb. He doesn't think big bomb, radioactive fallout, permanent night throughout the world. I mean, he doesn't think that way. He doesn't have knowledge. He doesn't have any knowledge of history. He doesn't have any knowledge of anything that really matters that you would want in a president of the United States, regardless of whether he were a Republican or a Democrat. And the marginal difference between those two we can explore. But anyway, I want to tell you a little bit. I guess I'm going to have to go personal here. I have to also confess that until I walked in here, I didn't know we didn't have phones. So don't call. There's no point. The lines are dead. Is it a conspiracy? No. It's a failing of older copper wire. Or maybe a conspiracy. Why not? Well, maybe a conspiracy. Anyway, I don't think so. The gremlins of old wiring have attacked us, and we are helpless before those enormous physical forces. So, and Abe isn't here. So I'm kind of stuck in an interesting situation, which I did not plan for, which is to talk. If you are patient and are willing to listen, the stories I will tell, I think, are fairly interesting. But I did not really line up a way of doing this that's going to be super coherent. So it's inevitably going to have to be based around my own experiences and a little bit about my background. What the hell? I'm, first of all, very old. I'm 77 years old. I remember World War II as a child. My father worked in the shipyards at the Brooklyn Naval Yards for Bethlehem Steel, repairing mostly hospital ships that were torpedoed. And I found out from him years later that part of his job would be to go to the edges of the port of New York. There was then a huge chain set, a net that went under the channel there. And when a ship came to that point, two tugboats would grab the chain, take it off of its whatever, and pull it back, and the ships could come in. This was against submarines. And his job was to, at that point, board the ship and appraise the damage of the torpedoing. Most of those ships were hospital ships. And many of those ships had prisoners, many of them Italian workers who were being brought to work in the United States in the fields. Interesting thing that many people don't know. But if they were in those holds below decks, if they were in those spaces, and the ship got torpedoed, they couldn't leave. They drowned in a terrible, terrible way. And when those were opened, and he had to look at the damage, and he had to deal with it, all these dead people were lying there. It was quite a trauma for him, I'm sure, and God knows it was a terrible thing for those prisoners. I think it's important. One of the things I remember, too, was him coming home at like probably 6:30 in the morning, and I would wake up. I was a little kid, 4 years old, around that, 3-4 years old, and he would sit down with me. I was still in bed, and he would draw me what a dry dock is and how it works, and he would explain various mechanisms of ship repair. And I actually remember that stuff, and I'm very grateful. He's gone now, of course, but I remember that, and I'm very grateful for his teaching me a little bit of engineering and mechanical stuff. Now, also, my parents were people who really believed in the possibility of a left-wing change in the United States. Remember, they were children of the Great Depression, their lives, their young adult lives, were marked by the failings of American industrial capitalism. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his enormous attempts to build social democracy that was welcomed by Congress because everybody was very scared of revolution. In those days, I think there was too little understanding of what the Soviet Union was really about, too much hope based on the possibilities of socialism worldwide to really grasp the totalitarian aspect of Russia in those days, and to understand it in a very limited sense. In any event, there was a large, large number of people who were leftists in that period of time. There are estimates from the FBI that there were as many as 1 million members of the Communist Party during the late 30s and into the early 40s. I have no idea whether that's true. There's no way for anyone to know, I think. Certainly the FBI doesn't really know. In any event, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was caught in a bit of a bind. Our ally at that point was the Soviet Union. In fact, that war, World War II, was largely won by the Soviets, who took enormous losses and suffered enormous horrors and moved their industrial might, such as it was, to the other side of the Ural Mountains in preparation for the Nazi advances, and were able to rebuild huge armies, many of them Asians. And when the time came, and when the Germans had exhausted their power and were bogged down first in mud and then in snow, a long, starving time came to the Soviet Union. And after that, the Red Army suddenly appeared when the Germans were kind of worn out and trapped. And they swooped down upon them, and they began to move toward the West, and they kept coming, and they kept coming, and they kept coming. Meanwhile, the European allies and the United States worked from Africa and then Italy, and there was an enormous pressure on the left in America to open a second front, as it was called, to stop the horrors of Nazism. We didn't at that point know, we general populations, I don't know what the OSS knew, but we didn't know about the concentration camps and the Holocaust at that moment. As the Soviets moved from the East to the West, it became more and more clear that they were very likely to overrun all of Europe. And in fact, they advanced to the place where they controlled half of Germany. They controlled Hungary, they controlled Romania, they controlled, I'm not going to list all the country, Bulgaria. They controlled what was all called countries behind the Iron Curtain. That's a term developed by Churchill, who was a rabid anti-communist. And that was the stasis for a long, long time until the economic realities of the failing of a totalitarian state, which could not really provide the goods and services that the West could. I want to be clear about this. Capitalism delivers the goods. I got an opportunity to talk at kind of an independent little school, kind of a red school here in Portland. It was over at the American Friends Service Committee. And I think I horrified people there by saying that you have to remember that capitalism delivers the goods. Well, it does, but there's a price for delivering the goods, and we're beginning to pay that price now. We're seeing it almost everywhere, and we are really in a very dangerous situation. At any rate, the United States and the Soviet Union and England, to a significant extent, and France, kinda, and Holland, and so on, won World War II. As soon as it was clear that there was an end to the war in Europe, the Soviet Union, as per agreement, declared war on Japan. And the Japanese, who were into a kind of denial, a nationalist religious denial of their foolishness in making the war start, and their foolishness of doing Pearl Harbor and so on, continued to fight. And it was at that point that, of course, Roosevelt was gone, that Truman, who knew nothing of it, agreed to using nuclear weapons. And we, as you know, probably most of you, some of you are younger, but as you know, the only country ever to use nuclear weapons in war was the United States of America, bombing Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. That opened up a whole new realm of terror, which really, really changed the nature of the world situation in terms of war. And it's important to realize that nuclear war is not a stoppable phenomenon, and it will produce a nuclear winter, which maybe, very likely I should say, would destroy most animal life and much of plant life if it was a big nuclear exchange. And that made it really kind of untenable, the idea of having a nuclear war. And both sides agreed eventually to reduce their stockpiles of nuclear weapons, but there's many thousands of such weapons. The United States developed a system, a tripart system of nuclear submarines, hardened missile bases, and bombers that could deliver nuclear weapons within minutes of the direction of the President of the United States. The President of the United States still has the power to launch those weapons without a declaration of war from Congress. The Constitution says declaration of war must take place with the approval of Congress. Note that the Korean War, the Vietnam War to a great extent, and the two Gulf Wars were not wars declared through the due process described in the Constitution. So already we have a change in the power relations. Now, that was all scary. It was scary as a joke when Ronald Reagan said we were declaring war off the camera. He was joking. It was sort of a thing to be afraid of. There was a great movie, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Love the Bomb. There was a great deal of propaganda to make sure that we didn't continue with nuclear war. And I should say, in the meanwhile, we were testing nuclear weapons, first in the Pacific, including a hydrogen bomb, and then in Nevada, at the nuclear testing grounds. And we discovered that women's breast milk had strontium-90 in it. Now, strontium is a thing you need for your bones. It readily is absorbable, but when it is in the isotope form of strontium-90, it is a toxin. So babies were being poisoned by their mother's own milk. And all this became more and more real. Meanwhile, also, there was a effort to persuade the American people that nuclear war was survivable. We learned to hide under our desks to survive a nuclear attack, and duck and cover with a little song. Many people became involved in civil defense. Philip Wiley, a then very popular author, wrote a book called Tomorrow, which advocated preparation for survival of a nuclear attack and the survivability of it. There was, in other words, an enormous propaganda to legitimize the possibility of a nuclear exchange. And similar preparations took place elsewhere. The Russians had built huge, beautiful subways, which were very deep. The English already had them. Ours are less so. But they were places which probably would, initially at least, be places where people could survive nuclear attack. In the midst of all this, people like me, and there were quite a few of us, many of us were associated with pacifist groups. Many of us were people of religious faith, began to be very much interested in opposing the nuclear testing for obvious reasons of its horrible poisonousness, but also to try to persuade the American people that a nuclear war must be avoided at all cost. In the context of that, and here's where I guess I come in, 1960, I was in Portland. I had dropped out of college, Reed College, in fact, and I got a job designing window displays at Meyer and Frank. Yeah, I was a window display designer. Bleh. It was an okay job. I learned to use invisible wire. By the way, invisible wire is very, very thin, very powerful steel, black steel, very thin, very thin, which if you wrapped both ends of a piece of it around pieces of wood, you could garrote, that is, choke to death and probably even cut through the carotid arteries. I shouldn't tell you about weapon systems. Anyway, so I used invisible wire to hang stuff in window displays, and in general, they paid poorly, but it was a good job for me. Most days, my rent was like $30 a month for a tiny apartment. I, in 1960, decided, because I'd been influenced by the non-communist left, particularly the old socialist party left and the pacifist groups that were then very numerous and the struggles of the civil rights movement that were really underway at that point, I decided to try to organize against the bomb and against the testing of the bomb. And I was, I think, pretty naive, but I found many allies within the Friends and within various the Methodists and various Christian groups, as well as others of that of other faiths or non-faiths. And in 1960, I and many others organized the first peace march since the 1930s. And it was in Portland. And in order to do that, I was told I had to go talk to the police red squad called the Intelligence Squad. And there's a guy named Charlie Trumbull, who I got to know over the years, a police officer. And he told me, he said, well, you know, you're going to get used by the communists if you do this stuff. And I said, I rather thought we could use them. I think it puzzled him. But and he wanted to give us one lane on Broadway for our march. And I said, you can't ask old folks to be marching with the carbon monoxide poison from buses and so on. We need the whole of Broadway. Which eventually we were granted, and we held a march that maybe had 500 people in it, 1960. Later, the next fall, a larger march took place with the great help of a guy who was in the legislature and a very nice, very sweet man, Howard Willits, now gone. And we organized, he helped, he got some money from some wealthier folk, and he actually created an office, and we worked very hard, and we got a lot of people's support, and we organized something called the UN March for Peace, which immediately was disavowed by the local association for the United Nations. But nevertheless, we rented a whole bunch of world flags, nation flags, and we marched. Some people marched all the way from where the nuclear response location was in, I think, Powell Butte. And we actually had more than 1,000 people marching up Broadway. At that point, I moved to New York. I'm sorry that this is so kind of egotistical, but again, I can only tell you what I know that I'm prepared to talk about, and this is a little limited. So if it's too boring, you can go to, I don't know, there's not a lot of choices on the radio that are serious, but you can do that, or turn it off and listen to some good music. But here we are. I'm telling this story because I don't know what else to do at this moment. So and I also, while I was in New York, I went to Columbia University. And at the same time, I was associated with the various peace movement, the non-communist peace movements in New York City, and David McReynolds and people like that. And I also was very privileged to learn nonviolent techniques and to be able to help the Corps in its effort to create jobs for black people in Ebinger's Bakery, which was a large, very good traditional Jewish bakery system in Brooklyn. And they didn't hire black people, and we picketed and we did civil disobedience and so on. I did civil disobedience trainings. And we were effective. Eventually, Ebinger's was integrated. And these were the things that were happening in the North all the time. In the South, a more powerful movement began under the leadership of Rosa Parks, for example. And by the way, her arrest was a planned, you know, she knew what she was doing with civil disobedience. And the leadership of Martin Luther King, a great struggle took place, which resulted eventually in the Civil Rights Acts in the administration of President Johnson. Johnson, by the way, is a tragic figure. He believed, he was very much of an anti-communist, and he believed that in the theory that if you didn't stop the communist advance in Vietnam, then all of the Asian nations would be at danger. And he said in a speech that the tin and the oil and other valuable resources in that region would be lost forever to the West. There was then the theory that there was a monolithic communist menace, that Russia and China were, along with the nations under the control of Russia, were in effect a single body bent on the destruction of Western capitalism. Turned out not to be so, of course. As you all probably know, Vietnam is a much more complex issue. The victory of the Vietnamese people over the United States is a classic example of what modern response can be to powerful nation states' attempts to occupy and control other places. It's also the case that after the Vietnam War, after our miserable defeat, our pointless struggle, and the horrors that we inflicted with napalm and Agent Orange and huge bombings of North Vietnam, after all of that, the Chinese invaded Vietnam. I bet a lot of you don't know that. And were defeated resoundingly, which resulted in the decision by the Chinese to reorganize and upgrade their armies. And I guess I should go back even further to talk about what happened with the division of Korea, and because it's relevant right now, obviously. The decision to divide the country at the 38th parallel was basically a decision of the Soviet Union and the United States. And that meant essentially that there would be an uneasy truce that would go on and on and on. Well, South Korea was able to become an economic industrial powerhouse, while North Korea maintained itself as an agricultural totalitarian state under the leadership of a single family, and you know what that's led to. And I also wanted, this is a good time to introduce the fact, that poorer nations discovered, there was a guy named Khan who had information about how to create nuclear weapons, how to develop centrifuges to produce enriched bomb-grade nuclear materials, and he gave his techniques to many nations. This meant that, for example, Pakistan and to a lesser extent India and other countries, most notably North Korea, to be able to build nuclear weapons. And the technology of rocketry was already well developed, first by the Germans, whose people fled to the West and became our experts at intercontinental ballistic missiles. In that situation, North Korea really didn't have a lot of resources to fight, and it was run by one family, and it has now developed, probably, we don't know for sure, effective intercontinental ballistic missiles with the deliverability of nuclear weapons to the United States of America. And that's the situation we're in now. So the family that runs North Vietnam, the leadership is isolated, it is angry, it is a bit crazy, and I love to call the current leader of North Korea the Little King. But now I'm backing away from that because the crazy president of the United States calls him Rocket Boy. But if you were a nation state today trying to maintain your independence from the rest of the world, the decision to go to nuclear weapons makes absolute sense. The decision also to go to intercontinental ballistic missiles makes sense for much less cost than creating huge modern aircraft and huge modern armies. You can effectively protect yourself, at least theoretically, from the danger, and I put quotes around that, of places like the United States, or for that matter, China, or for that matter, Russia. So inevitably, the situation we're in right now in Korea came about, consequent to the development of nuclear weapons and the development of modern rocketry under the leadership originally of Nazi Germany, and then from the scientists who were captured by both Russia, some by Russia and some by the United States, who designed a lot of very effective nuclear weapons delivery systems, ballistic missiles, and so on. Well, that's the situation. That is the situation. So back to those days, in that time and place, there was an enormous effort to reach out to create an alternative to what many of us perceived as a horrible end to the human race, to all life on Earth, with nuclear war. A funny thing happened to me in 1966. for some stupid egotistical reason and a little bit of outrage over the stupidity of college politics, I ran for student body president at Portland State, then still a college. And to my absolute amazement, in 66, I won, which put me in charge of a significant budget. A woman named Catherine Corbett, a brilliant woman, a socialite who worked very hard, had developed a program to make student government monies useful in terms of bringing brilliant speakers, creating lots of great programs, a film program, orchestral music, all kinds of stuff, and to have monies available to bring guest speakers. All of this was nominally placed in the hands of the student government. So I found myself ill-prepared, but running a government that actually had money. And I discovered, this was the middle of the time when marijuana became popular, when there was the hippy-dippy thing, when LSD was around. You know, hard to remember the naivete that we all faced. During that period of time, I discovered that I could put on dances. The old dances were kind of like pajama hops and kind of 1950s events. Maybe the sororities and fraternities would attend them. They were never money makers. But I found out that if I put the right music with the right kind of light shows or whatever, I could actually make money in the rock and roll business, which began to give the student government a certain degree of independence because we were making money rather than spending money alone. Very exciting time for me. I was silly. I didn't know what I was doing. I made a lot of mistakes. But the fact of the matter is that 66, 67 was a kind of a milestone in the possibility of student government. It wasn't unique to me. Same thing was happening at Stanford. The same thing was happening at the University of Oregon. The same thing was happening all over the country. In other words, the student movements were growing. And awareness of the dangers of the time and the possibilities of a more just future. By the way, we were not really revolutionaries. We didn't want to overthrow, for example, capitalism. What we all had as a universal vision, though I guess I called myself at that point an anarchist, the vision that we had was of a society where there could be the opportunities of development through capitalism, but that would have as its base in the model of social democracies in places like Sweden and Germany and France, national health care systems, basic services, childcare, good schools, decent housing, and so on, at the same time that there would be an entrepreneurial opportunity structure. Far from a Soviet-style revolution. And we became, all of us, more and more aware of what the Soviet Union had become and the totalitarian nature of it. That subtlety, it doesn't seem subtle to me now and probably not to you, but that subtlety was totally lost in America because the whole premise of American struggle against the Soviet Empire was built around the idea that there would be a war and that the danger of that war would be, if everyone survived it, that was part of the premise, that would be a totalitarian structure throughout the world in the model of the Soviet Union. And already we knew, all of us, that the Soviet model had great failings. It was totalitarian. People couldn't speak out. There were all kinds of things wrong with it. So there was this independent, interesting, multivariant structure of left-wing critiques, radical left-wing critiques. People like Herbert Marcuse and the whole school, I'm not going to talk about this a lot, but the whole school that came out of Frankfurt, people who ran away from the Nazi era, went to work at American universities and French universities and so on, began to examine a third way, an alternative to the this or that approach of American monopoly capitalism and the totalitarian regimes of the Soviet Union and of China then. And there was, in the United States, a popular conception that there was this red menace, that the Russians and the Chinese were somehow united together in a vast conspiracy all over the world to take over the world. And this was, of course, the meat and potatoes of the FBI under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover, who was a really weird proto-fascist. Anyway, at that point, I was one of the people who signed a call among student government leaders to oppose the war in Vietnam, to have a moratorium on the war. My punishment for that was to be labeled a communist. I had briefly flirted with communist politics, found them lacking in the United States, certainly lacking generally, and had come back to the positions that I had in the social democratic anti-fascist movement of the earlier 60s. But without any real opportunity to respond, J. Edgar Hoover's people put out press releases and so on, essentially accusing me of being a communist. The Oregonian and the Oregon and the Oregon Journal, which were then, we had two newspapers, both under, little did we know, under the control of the Newhouse empire of newspapers, came out accusing me with no opportunity, in fact, to respond. No reporter called me and asked me about it, with headlines, PSU student body president named as red, which is a kiss of death. It was very weird, and very scary. Meanwhile, at Portland State, we created a film program that was really good, really cutting edge. We created these dances, as I said. We invited speakers. I was able to bring just about any of the great speakers of that time, Stokely Carmichael, leader and then of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Timothy Leary, who turned out to be a jerk, to talk about psychedelic drugs, many, many people, different people of that era. And it was a very different kind of situation. But in the course of that, and being labeled a red, and having to deal with that was really, I was a child, really. I was hardly prepared. I was caught up in a weird vortex of psychedelia, of left-wing thinking, of ill-conceived ideas about changing the world. And I can remember being in my office and having a press conference about how I wasn't a communist, that I was an anarchist, which probably wasn't the best response. Meanwhile, to the faculty's credit at Portland State, they passed a resolution supporting me. And at the same time, I saw a lot of reporters. One of them was Nancy Duncan. Her father was then a congressperson, and she was an, I believe, AP reporter, and she came to see me toward the end of one day. And I was going home for dinner, and I asked her, you know, she wanted to interview me. I said, well, you want to come home and see how a leftist lives? We lived, by the way, in a very humble environment, an old farmhouse on the hillside below the med school on Barber Boulevard. My partner was a social worker at that point. She and I got there, I was essentially told that we had been getting a bunch of phone calls telling us to get out of town. The right wing had already put spray-painted a hammer and sickle on my white Volvo, my old Volvo. There was a very aggressive right-wing movement at that point in Portland. The police were essentially working in hand in glove with those people at that point. It was an odd situation. So Nancy Duncan and my partner and I sat down. Meanwhile, a friend of mine, Jim, a large man who was in a band called the Great Pumpkin, a great musician, by the way, but a very big man who had at one point had a scholarship at Berkeley to play rugby, just to give you an idea of who he was. Half-jokingly, I said, do you want to be my bodyguard? He said, yeah. And so he was at my house. We called the police. Nancy wanted that to happen, and my partner wanted that to happen. The police came while we were eating. On one wall, now remember, this was a time when we were not really educated in a lot of the issues that today are important. So on one wall was a poster for a Greek movie based on Greek mythology. The poster featured a very young woman with a bare bosom, a black and white photo. So that was on one wall. the two policemen came to our house, and one took one look at Jim, who kept standing up the whole time and acting very silently aggressive. I remember the policeman saying, "Big, isn't he?" To which he said, "Yeah." And to which I said, "Yeah, yeah." And the policeman said, "Well, was he kind of a bodyguard?" I said, "Well, he's a friend. He came over, you know." And the other officer kept finding his eyes drifting over to this poster, which was, I guess, quite a shocker to him, of this bare-bosomed young woman. Something I would not have today, something I would be embarrassed about, and I am embarrassed about, but, you know, it was part of that time. We were confused. We were, I think, in that point in history, quite sexist. But that was part of a huge cultural change that was taking place. The clarity and the wisdom that really was needed only was possessed by a very few people, and I'm sorry to say that people I knew were not appropriately aware. But at the same time, here's this woman. Her father is a member of Congress. She's an AP reporter. She's, I don't know what she wrote eventually, because I was sort of out of it. It was overwhelming for me. One policeman said, "Do you have a gun?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I have a pistol." And he said, "Well, make sure they're inside your door stoop before you shoot them. Seriously." And Nancy went, "Yeep!" Understandably. And they left. We finished our meal. I tell you that story to give you some sense of the weirdness of that time. And I was so out of it. I don't know what she wrote, if anything. I don't know what her thinking was at the time about who I was. I know her father was a conservative Democrat, the dominant figure in the East County area in politics, the functional equivalent of Earl Blumenauer today, Earl being a much sharper and better politician. But Duncan favoring the war. And I remember before I had actually been student body president, I was invited to be on KGW television. Students talk with the congressman, and we all were on these very high stools. And at one point, he had a line that was pretty standard for him. He said, "It is better to fight them in the elephant grass of Vietnam than the rye grass of Oregon." And I thought that was so funny, I deliberately fell off the stool. And I kind of remember that was a shocker of that moment, probably irrelevant to most people, and I doubt that anybody listening to this show saw that TV show. But it was the nature of it, the beginning of a sense of the ultimate absurdity of the potential of nuclear war and the absurdity of this horrible, miserable, awful, unwinnable, as it turned out, as we all thought it would be, war in Vietnam. People's war was then a concept of that time. Now, I mention this because, unfortunately, a wise man, a great president, President Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, who supported civil rights legislation, fell into the great trap of the military-industrial complex. By the way, C. Wright Mills wrote the first really definitive analysis of that phenomenon. He fell into that, and he absolutely supported the war and the whole idea begun by the Eisenhower administration that country by country would be swallowed up by the Red Menace. As you know, it turned out not to be true, but unfortunately it involved the slaughter of many American young men. We had a draft. There was this horrible war going on. We were fighting a very dedicated indigenous war in Vietnam, and it was unwinnable, untenable, because it was a people's war, and there was a strong military ability to deal with stuff. And it was obvious that we were not winning. We were being lied to. And this went on and on and on, and this radicalized more and more people. In 1970, there was an outrage. Remember, there was a draft, so young men were really angry about being forced into the military. More and more people had doubts about it. There was a great split within the culture of those who were supporting the war and those who were opposed to it. The civil rights struggle was well underway, and because of the great leadership from the South and elsewhere, great improvements in the lives of persons of color were taking place. That was the beginning of the women's movement. A lot of interesting things were happening. At the same time, Johnson was stuck in this model, essentially, of the advancement of communism and the need to have these wars to stop its advance. This would lead to many disasters. This would lead, for example, just to jump way ahead, into the deal that was made by the American government, the CIA in particular, to trade, because the Congress didn't want to go for it, to get money to fight wars in Central America by making available in America cocaine, which was largely sold then in the ghettos of America. It led to much disaster and many people ending up, particularly persons of color, ending up in prison. All of this is a prelude to what is now the case. A great, powerful left wing was being born by students. But in 70, it erupted in the shooting of students at a black college in Mississippi, Jackson State, which was largely ignored, but the killing of students in Ohio, the Kent State Massacre, where the National Guard used live bullets to shoot unarmed students protesting the war, which led in turn to a vast strike against the institutions of public education and private education throughout the United States. And Portland State took place in that. And at Portland State, there were many actions, and I think we're going to run out of time before I need to describe some of the funny stuff that happened, but that eventually it culminated in there had been built a geodesic dome in the park box across from the Smith Center at Portland State. And it was supposed to be for people who were sick or needed help or whatever. And there were these little encampments that blockaded the roads around Portland State in the park blocks. There was an agreement to take those down, but the tent, as it was called, it wasn't a tent, was still in the park blocks. I had wandered. I was then kind of a nobody. I was a graduate student. I went up to Shattuck School, which was part of Portland State, to their playground area, and I saw Lieutenant Brulette's top squad, as he called it, which was essentially a riot squad with longer, they called them batons, but they're big clubs, 2 foot long or so, clubs of white. They had different helmets, different, in those days the police weren't armored like they are today. Today they are amazingly armored. And his little organization were pushing against each other, I swear this is true, and saying what sounded to me like, now I'm not sure, but sounded to me like as they would push against each other, they would say, you're a pig, who's a pig, piggy, piggy, pig. I'm not, as far as I know, making that up. Something like that. And it was quite weird, quite weird. And I went back to the students who had decided they would make a stand around this so-called tent and they would do nonviolent resistance, and some would sit down and some would stand up. And I said, let's move this over to what was then an empty lot across the way. Let's just pick this plastic tent thing, geodesic dome, and move it over there and we'll have the last laugh. But no, they wanted to make a stand. They figured they'd get arrested, they'd win in court, blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, what they didn't understand was it was the intention of Lieutenant Brulette, and by the way, his name was pronounced Brulé, I don't know why, that his top squad would arrest everybody. Instead, what happened is the police separated all of us who were not resisting with their blue helmets and isolated the group that were resisting, and the top squad came in a V. And they gave a loudspeaker request that everybody move or they would be arrested. They were not. What happened instead was they marched into the crowd using their clubs to hit people and bash people and smash people and in general create mayhem. And people ran away. And that was the first, most significant exhibition of the power of the police department in Portland against young people. Well, guess what? we've run out of time, and I'm glad of that, and I hope this wasn't too boring, and I hope it was somewhat instructive, and I suppose, really, because it's just me, it was a little too egotistical, but what can I say? Y'all keep the struggle going. It's a good time in life to be an activist, and a bad time in life to be looking at the world through the eyes of a weird Trump fascist administration.
It's coming through a crack in the wall on a visionary flood of alcohol from the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. The December 18th meeting of the Board of Directors will be held at 6 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm/board-directors.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Gorgeous Christmas Tree Fundraiser on Saturday, December 16th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Community of Christ Church in Portland. Food by Design is offering live native 5-foot-tall Doug firs in pots for the holidays. Afterwards, they will plant them in the Columbia Gorge as part of the restoration efforts. This community pickup day event will also feature hot cocoa, music, and festivities. Again, that's the Gorgeous Christmas Tree Fundraiser on Saturday, December 16th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Community of Christ Church, 4837 Northeast Cooch in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.